Good afternoon, everyone. It's June 6, 2011, and it is 2:35. Welcome to Rules. And we're going to start with a work session, open up a work session on House Bill 3667.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3667, you had last week. It directs the Oregon Health Authority to establish levels of licensure for emergency medical services, since these are EMS providers. It modifies emergency medical services provider terminology. There is no amendment that I know of for this bill, and we have no revenue impact, and we have a fiscal statement that has been issued, and you have a copy of that fiscal statement.
Have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3667 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Hunt moves House Bill 3667 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? And Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Freeman?
Excused.
Excused?
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Excused.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Berger?
Aye.
Co-chair
Hunt? Aye. Co-chair Olson? Aye. House Bill 3667 passes.
Just barely squeaked through there.
So,
you have a carrier for it?
And I'll carry that. Okay, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3667 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3688.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3688. It allows beverage distributors to establish a cooperative for the purpose of processing beverage containers, as well as collecting and refunding beverage container refund values among the distributors and dealers. It requires the cooperative to service a majority of the state's dealers. It allows that the dealer using the cooperative is not required to return containers to distributor who does not participate in the cooperative, provided the cooperative makes an accounting of the containers it redeems that were distributed by the non-participating distributor. It requires non-participating distributor to pay the refund value of the redeemed containers specified in the accounting to the cooperative or dealer. It requires the cooperative to report beverage container return data to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and it prohibits the Liquor Control Commission from disclosing return data provided by the cooperative.
So I have Senator Nelson, Senator Johnson, is Representative Nathanson trying to sneak in too? No. Okay. Senators.
And with the chair's permission, I have someone with me.
Okay. Bodyguard?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not me.
Come on.
Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16.
I'm State Senator David Nelson, Senate District 29, Pendleton.
I'm Willis Van Dusen, the co-owner of Van Dusen Beverages with Pepsi-Cola Bottler in Astoria.
Mr. Chair, I'll tee this up. We're waiting for amendments right now that were being proofread in Ledge Council. The issue before Senator Nelson and me is the effect that this bill will have on forcing some distributors into the co-op against their desires, contrary to their business plan, and at considerable expense to them. Mr. Van Dusen came to speak specifically to some amendments that we would like to offer today. Senator Nelson is here on behalf of his constituents with amendments that he would like to offer, and we would just respectfully ask the committee to take into consideration that the bottle bill has now passed to everyone's satisfaction. This last little piece that forces some of these outlying distributors to join OBRC against their wishes remains, and I think Senator Nelson and I would submit to you, is it the business of the Oregon legislature to be changing the business models to the detriment of businesses? Mayor Van Dusen will elaborate that two of his Teamsters will be laid off as a result of this if he's forced to join the co-op, and with that, I would, with your permission, turn it over to Mr. Van Dusen.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, co-chairs, I'm Willis Van Dusen, and the co-owner of Van Dusen Beverages, and
I am here in opposition of House Bill 3688. I really do not believe that it is fair or equitable. And the one portion that really says it all is Section 2, Paragraph 3. Just saying that if a distributor cooperative is established, which there is, and OBRC, which, by the way, they're very fine people. I have no problem with those individuals. But if this co-op is...
I think, Wilson, if you could just kind of pull back away. There you go.
I apologize. Last time I testified a different issue, they said the same thing to me, so I apologize. Anyway, then the store is not required to return those cans and bottles to a distributor that's not a member of the co-op. But if they are a member of the co-op, they do get the benefit of the recycled material. I really just do not believe that is fair. We're a very small bottler. We have 12 Teamsters. Two of these Teamsters will lose their job. We purchased new equipment, including the repairs to the building to hold the equipment, in excess of $100,000. And that was in 2008. We actually got an Oregon tax credit for the recycled value to the community. It's a very important part of our business plan. Our trucks go, they take off from Astoria, they go to Arch Cape, Cannon Beach, Jewel, Plaskanai, and they unload their product and they come back empty. If we were forced to join the cooperative, then we would be compensating the cooperative to send additional trucks to those same locations, pick up the bottles and cans, and take them to Portland, which would be processed in a plant in Portland, and then our value would be the amount to pay the expense would be deducted. So it would cost us money. We would not have any way to recoup those expenses. We still have to send the trucks out. Our costs would be the same. Our fuel would be the same. The only savings we would have is the individuals running those machines. So the one other comment I'd like to make is when the bottle bill, which just passed, came up, I supported that, and I was asked by many people. I mean, it's been a lot of work for a long time. We've been in the business since 1947. But this portion of it was never included. And when I've talked to Senator Johnson, called me, what do you think about this bottle bill? I said, I support it. We can work on this. It helps Oregon. And then, so after it passed, this second item came up, and I was told by many people it was tied to the bottle bill. Well, I didn't know that. And if I would have known that, I would not have supported the bottle bill, and there's many others that would not. So I think if it is tied together, I don't really think that's fair. So I would hope that you would consider small distributors, those of us that have invested a lot of money, that equipment is the most expensive piece of equipment we own, and not pass this unfair law. Is there any questions?
Well, wait.
I'm sorry. Okay. I apologize.
Yes, yes, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. I represent Eastern Oregon, basically.
Senator Nelson, we know who you are, but just if you identify who you are.
Okay, I did once, but this is State Senator David Nelson, District 29 from Pendleton. And I have kind of an interesting situation with this bill because I do have some distributors out there that are very much in favor of this bill and are members of the co-op. But I've got probably a lot. I don't know if there's more or not, but it stretches from Pendleton to LeGrand over into the Ontario area, which I don't represent. But there's folks out there that it's the time and the distance. They feel that they have a process in place. They would like to make an agreement with the co-ops to work something out. But there seems to be a little conflict there between the people from the cooperative and these local folks. I've been trying to get them together and say, okay, let's sit down, let's come up with some sort of agreement. Because I think, as the mayor said, that there's, you know, there's time and there's distance involved. And when you get out in Eastern Oregon, that's really a big issue as far as we're concerned. Really a big issue. We also have the issue of cross-state just recycling. You know, Washington State doesn't have a recycling bill. So there are times when our distributors out there recycle 120 or 130% of the bottles. And they just don't feel that this bill is going to, you know, force them to join this cooperative. It's kind of against their business sense. And I think that, you know, the feeling that I get is that they want to be cooperative. They're going to participate in the new bill that you just passed very much. They'll do whatever they can to help with the recycling portion of it. But it's just this mandate that they have to join this co-op. And there's issues with Walmart and things of that nature. But I'm saying, well, these are guys out in Eastern Oregon. We maybe have a couple Walmart stores around, but not very many. It's just a little bit of a different situation. And I agree with these guys that, you know, why should I be forced to join something? You know, I'm a farmer by trade, basically, and I have a choice. I can either join a co-op or I cannot join a co-op. And if it's in my best interest, then I might join. But if it's not, and these folks obviously think that it's not, so I'm going to be presenting an amendment -3 that exempts those distributors in counties of the state that have a population of 80,000 or less. The reason for that is Umatilla County has a population of right around 72 or 75,000. I don't know what the latest census is. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, before you go to questions, I also have -4 amendments that would have counties with a population of 40,000 and have been determined by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to have invested $100,000 or more on or before January the 1st, 2009. And both of these amendments leave open the opportunity for a distributor in either one of the counties with the population to participate in a distributor co-op. It would give a little bit more time, I think, to work out the issues that Senator Nelson alluded to. Also, as we were coming in the door, the question arose of whether or not reporting would be required if the committee sees fit to adopt either of these amendments or both of these amendments. I'm sure that the reporting requirement could be satisfied in order to meet the 80% of the bottle bill. I don't see that there's any difficulty with
there is no difficulty
with reporting requirements. We'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
May I ask a question? Sure. The -4 amendment, it's from Legislative Council?
Yes, sir. That's why we were a little bit late coming in. The proofreaders are kind of worn out with me today as we've been drafting multiple amendments to this bill.
And eventually staff will have the -4 amendments?
We brought extra copies for the committee and the staff. I mean, literally, you saw my staff hand them to me because the proofreaders at Leg Council have a little bad picture of me up in their office today. So we're happy to offer these.
Do
you have any questions?
Yeah, committee. Just not. All right. Thanks, Senators.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Sean Miller and Paul Ramon. Chatsworth. Well, it sounds a little better. I mean, it's
co-chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in support of House Bill 3688. And now, as was alluded to, this bill is familiar to this chamber. It was House Bill 3704 in the 2010 legislature. Did pass both chambers with super majorities, but was vetoed by the governor. Just recently, it did receive a veto override in the House with 54 votes, but we are bringing it back today in a bill, and would urge your support of 3688. We'd like to comment just on a few items, even though I know we've addressed some of the policy reasons. But in 2007, when the last expansion of the bottle bill went to water bottles, one significant key to that expansion was that for the first time we were to accept containers that we did not sell. And so we made that work, and the reason we made that work is the entire industry had to change. It had to change in significant ways as regional entities into a statewide cooperative to make that work and to be able to track the nickel. It's a very complicated process, but tracking that nickel is very difficult without modernizing the bottle bill. This is a key element to that, and I've heard arguments that this bill forces someone to join the co-op. It doesn't force someone to join the co-op because it gives them the option, and the primary reason they have the option to join the co-op or not, and the bill does spell out that, is so we don't have to double sort in our grocery stores, everything in the back room, one for the co-op, all the material, and a piece of the material that's only designated for that non-participating distributor. And so that is a tremendous amount of work. And so because of 2007 and the industry had to change, and with that, we stepped up to the plate to work out an agreement on 3145 that does modernize the bottle bill. But this is a fix going back to 2007 that enables us to essentially not have to double sort and double accounting and basically double our entire workload in the back room of our grocery stores. And so with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, I would urge your support. I know Paul has some comments, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Mr. Romaine.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committees, or committee, I could be going plural on committees too. My name is Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I'll try and be a little less emotional than I was the last time I testified before you. Although this topic, you sort of do get emotional about it after a few years. Back in 2007, when it became apparent that we were going to be expanding the bottle bill, those of us in the distributor business had a choice. We could either sit and fight, or we could actually try and work out something that made the system work. And we met with a lot of different folks, and we decided to try and make it work. It's a very complex operation. People think it's very simple. In fact, it used to be very simple when all you had to do was take back your own product, because you had exclusive territories, and basically the person who sold it was probably the person who would pick it up, so it was very simple. But there were a couple of problems we had to solve in 2007, and one of them was universal redemption, and I don't mean that in a religious term. It was basically that you had to basically take back everything. If you sold something, you had to take back that category of product. And the question was, how do you pick up all that stuff when it's all around the state? How do you collect the deposits? It's not a simple process anymore, and that's what the original bill was designed to remedy. The bill before you does two things. One is reporting. It is absolutely essential that we have a reporting mechanism so everybody actually puts in their numbers to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission so we know how much product is being sold, where a deposit may be collected, and how much product is being redeemed or a deposit is being paid out. So we know those numbers. That's absolutely essential. The second part really addresses the extra workload that is placed upon a grocer when they're in an area where they have more than one, in effect, person coming in to pick up. Because that's the big problem for grocers. It's not, they get reimbursed a nickel for every container that comes in, they break even. The amount of work they have to do depends really upon the amount of backroom sorting they have to do and the amount of accounting they would have to do. And if you have multiple people coming in to pick up, you need to sort out everything. And that's what this bill says, is the grocer who has to sort has a choice. They could basically keep the scrap. It's up to, if the distributor wants to keep separate, then the grocer gets to pay for that extra amount of work they have to do by really keeping the scrap. It's the grocers to choose to do with it whatever they want. They could sell it to the highest bidder. They could give it away. They can do whatever they want with it, but it's theirs. That's the only two things this bill does. It's the choice of a distributor whether or not they wish to join. Most everybody in the state has joined a cooperative. And the reason, and most everybody in the state really didn't want to join a cooperative. I mean, frankly, if you would have taken a poll of our group, and I'm sure the soft drink people, prior to the 2007, and you would have said to them, do you want to expand the bottle bill and go to all this stuff, you would have gotten almost 100% saying, no, no way. Well, what happened is when you expanded, we had to change. And we did change. And yes, there are a couple of people out there that are holdouts. They're not huge. There were less of them, frankly, than were 2 years ago. or a year ago. In fact, a year ago, you had a couple other folks in here that were complaining. They're now members of the co-op. We would commend this bill to you. You need a statewide cooperative to make the bottle bill work. That's how it's done. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else like to speak on this bill? Okay. I'd like to close a public hearing on House Bill 3688 and open a work session on House Bill 3688.
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Don't promote the man.
I move House Bill 3688 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 3688 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes. Sure.
I would just say, obviously, this is the, as was pointed out in testimony, this is the, I guess, the third time the House will have voted on this issue. I think if we were getting, I mean, if we were back at a place earlier in the session, we were getting amendments, we could probably absorb them a little bit more. It's my major concern is, based on where we are in the session, that if we don't actually move a bill now, the Senate is going to adjourn and go home without us. And that's why I will support Representative Berger's motion.
Anyone else? Okay, Amy, if you could call the roll.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Excused. Aye. House Bill 3688 passes, and Representative Berger, you want to hear it?
Three to term.
Three to.
So we'll close the work session on House Bill 3688 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3673.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3673 would make the consumption of controlled substances by persons under the age of 21 equivalent to the unlawful possession of that controlled substance. Oregon law, of course, provides for the criminalization of the possession of controlled substances. However, once they enter your body, that possession is no longer criminal. The punishment for this crime would vary consistent with the statutes for possession of controlled substances, all the way up to a Class B felony for a Schedule 1 drug such as heroin, down to the violation level for something like marijuana.
Committee members, just of those of you who don't know Aaron Knott, he's on loan to us through to Judiciary Committee, so I'm feeling at home here all of a sudden, and he's also from employed with Multnomah County DA's office. So, okay, I'll call forward Captain Corey Darling, Mike Mounder.
Do you want to Senator Telfer?
And, pardon me?
Do you want Senator Telfer early, or she's here on this one?
And Senator Telfer. Thank you. Truly, Senator, you do have some bodyguards with you.
they're my bodyguards.
Okay.
Well, Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt, I'm Chris Telfer, Senator from District 27, usually known as the sunny part of the state. You know, I've got a lot better qualified people to speak to this, and as you said, the Senate is looking to adjourn here pretty soon, so I'll make this quick. Last year when I discovered in talking to our police department that it's okay, if a student comes to school, a minor comes to school drunk, there are consequences, legal consequences, and some good diversion into behavior modifications, and so, there's a lot of assistance for them. If a student comes to school stoned or under some other illegal drug, there
a very few consequences. So at that time, I thought that was wrong and that there could be some corrective action taken that would be beneficial to these students, beneficial to schools, beneficial to the safety of the schools and the students. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to more competent testimony.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt. My name is Corey Darling. I'm a captain with the City of Bend Police Department. And we have noticed a trend involving the increased drug usage of minors in the city of Bend. In 2008, we made 80 arrests for drug possession, delivery, or manufacture. Those numbers have increased to 102 in 2010, and thus far in 2011, the trend seems to be even increasing steadily. The trend of these statistics only indicate juveniles, as we do not capture the statistics for minors necessarily. Thus, the numbers would be even greater than that. What it does show and what it does not show are the minors that we have contacted on a daily basis that are under the influence of a controlled substance. We have found that those that are under the influence of alcohol tend to have there is a reason that they are using less alcohol. It seems to be that there is a deterrent in the law, which there is no deterrent thus far for being under the influence of controlled substances. And our primary goal is not only to implement some sort of a deterrent, but also to be able to identify those who are using controlled substances and be able to have some sort of intervention before it becomes problematic later in life.
Okay. Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, and the rest of the committee. My name is Mike Wander, and I'm a police officer for the City of Bend. My current assignment is I'm a school resource officer for Summit High School. I've had a wide variety of experience working with addiction issues and have recently filmed a documentary called Life Interrupted, A Battle Against Addiction, where I've worked with a lot of addicts. One of the things that I'm seeing when it comes to juveniles is that juveniles know that if they come to school and they are under the influence of marijuana, there is no consequences legally for them. That's why we have seen a pretty significant decline in alcohol-related issues in the school. We have seen a big increase of people under the influence of marijuana and other controlled substances, because they know that if they hide their drugs away from the school and they come into the school high, there's no legal ramification. It's a school suspension where they get sent home for either three days minimum and up to 10 days depending on prior issues with them. The other thing that is kind of hard to see is that I see a lot of young teens who are ruining their lives because they're under the influence of drugs. They come to school, they don't pass, eventually they start not coming to school, and eventually they end up dropping out or they end up in alternative programs. And there's nothing what we can do to help. So if I deal with a young person who is under the influence, I have nothing, no legal opportunity to put them or to put some, as I refer to as, teeth into them to where I can actually get them some help or try to, you know, set some standards for them so they understand what they're doing in their lives. And that's one of the things that we decided to bring this bill before you, is that I think it's very important that we finally get something there. Not so much, I think we're looking at, we talk about legal consequences. We're not saying we want to arrest them and put them in jail. What we want to say is we want to put them in a place where we can get them some help for treatment if they need the treatment, or something to make them aware of what kind of decisions they're making because of what could end up in the future for them. Thank you. Questions?
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand how this law would work, and I've been parsing it in the last couple minutes. It looks to me like the the section 2 that refers to all these statutes refers to a general possession statute and then to specific statutes involving specific drugs like heroin, marijuana, and a couple of other things. Could you describe how you would go about dealing with this bill if it passes, what you would do in the instance of a high school kid who you suspected of having consumed one of these drugs and sort of follow that through the next steps? And at recognizing, I recognize that what I think this bill does is it establishes a criminal statute for essentially possession by consumption that has the equivalent possible penalties of the possession statute when you have it in your hand, if I understand it right. So could you kind of describe how that would work in that situation, in those situations?
Yes, sir. I think it's...
It depends.
What we were looking at in this bill was to make it a violation, not an actual criminal offense, for minors to be under the influence. So basically what would happen is if we dealt with a young person who was under the influence, and we were able to determine that based upon our experience and our training of identifying those substances, then we would cite that person into juvenile court or into the court system as a violation, not as a physical arrest. At that point, they would appear before the juvenile system or the adult system, where maybe we could put some alternatives in place for them to either a drug assessment or a evaluation or something where they could get, we could start making them aware of what the consequences are for that.
Okay. Could I follow up? Now, this bill doesn't actually establish a violation, does it? Doesn't it establish it, these acts as equivalent to the level of felony or violation if they are of the statutes that are referred to in the bill?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is make it as equivalent as what the alcohol statute is. Because right now, like, an example would be minor in possession of alcohol. If you consume that alcohol, that is a violation of criminal law. If you're under the influence of any other drug, it is not a violation of law.
If I could follow,
Representative Barnhart, I don't believe it does do that.
Yeah, I don't either. That's right. That's the reason I'm asking the question.
Right.
I think, Mr. Chair, this bill, the way it's written, would establish the same penalties as the statutes it refers to.
I agree with you.
And that being the case, you don't get to what you're after in this bill. I wonder if anybody's proposing amendments that would get to what the proponents would like to have happen. I don't know if that's happened yet. Hasn't happened yet. Okay. Could I ask a couple more questions? I think you've already described how this would be a tool for schools. If I could be a little bit facetious, if the bill has passed as written were passed, you would no longer be a problem for a school because of the person in possession would be off to prison or some other way dealing with this Class B or Class C felony. But that isn't what you had in mind, is it?
No, sir.
Okay. I had some other questions, Mr. Chair, but I don't think they're relevant now that I've got what I've got on this one.
Okay. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I think Representative Barnhart may have asked my question already. I'm just trying to figure out what this bill is actually doing and what it isn't doing. So I'm just going to ask a couple questions, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, be very quick. So right now, currently, unlawful possession of a controlled substance, I assume, is against the law. And as well, unlawful consumption by a minor is against the law of a controlled substance. You're saying unlawful?
No.
Consumption is not against the law of a controlled substance.
That's correct.
That's correct.
So how do you determine whether somebody's actually consumed?
That's good.
I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out how is that going to play out. I'm just not. So if somebody is in possession, does this bill say that they're guilty of consumption?
I do not believe that if they're in actual possession, that does not necessarily mean they're under the statute of consumption as well. When we do an investigation for, say, a minor in possession of alcohol, the alcohol has been consumed, and we use our training and experience to establish the signs and symptoms that would relate to somebody under the influence of an alcoholic beverage. And that is the evidence that we present in order to prove that case. This would be very similar in a situation where we're dealing with somebody under the influence of a controlled substance. We do receive specialized training as law enforcement officers in that area, more specific to driving under the influence crimes, but still the training that we receive is practical in this instance. Trying to establish preponderance of evidence in a violation case is what we are looking for in this bill.
Just one quick. I guess I'm just concerned how you would identify whether they were under the or whether they have consumed a controlled substance as compared to Sudafed or something that may be a prescription drug or that was obtained legally or something over the counter even.
I think it's for me to sit here and explain that to you. I mean, I can tell you when
someone, I'm not trying to do it. You are. So
I understand that, and I'm trying to make it easy. I'm trying to find the right ways. Usually, how I determine if somebody's under the influence of anything is by talking with them, watching how their body is, how their eyes are. Just there's things. If you were example, might be a DUI. How do we tell if somebody's under the influence of intoxicants? We go through the field sobriety test. Real similar. Same when somebody comes and we're dealing with somebody under the influence of marijuana. You can tell by looking at them. Their eyes are bloodshot. They're red. You ask them, hey, what have you taken? They're right up front with you. It's just taking the time to go through it. Sometimes we find residue on them. Sometimes we find the pipe on them. So all these things lead to the preponderance of the evidence for us to base the criminal complaint on.
Further questions? One final one, if I could.
Go ahead,
Chair. Just to make certain I understand, if you're trying to convict somebody of a felony, you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. If you're trying to prove a violation, you need to prove it by
the preponderance of the evidence, like a traffic ticket.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I find this interesting, especially, Mike, right now, you being an SOR. Most teachers, are they not trained right now in high schools how to recognize a student that might be under the influence of whether it be alcohol or some type of a drug?
We have a person here from the school district who can explain that. But we have provided training in the past to teachers to be aware, and then what they would do is they would contact us for us to do the follow-up on that. That's usually how it works inside the school. But it's not just inside the school, and I'm talking to you from inside the school, but when we talk about outside the school, any city has issues of juveniles that are under the influence. And again, these are where we're trying to get these kids to where it doesn't lead to other things. I can tell you in my experience, I have seen more people who have started in the controlled substance thing where we haven't actually caught them with the product on them, but in 2 or 3 years now we're catching them with the product on them. They're involved in harder drugs, and next thing you know, we are putting them in prison. And that brings up a whole different other topic, because if we start by addiction now and trying to solve it now with something, we are going to save the state lots of money by not putting people in prison. And that's the whole idea behind it. Prison isn't going to be the right cure to put, to solve the drug problem. It's not. People have to hit rock bottom, but we also have to make sure that we have programs there that we can help them out. So the whole idea behind this is to get some teeth into this where we can actually take people before they take that next step. And that's what's important, is that next step, because once they get to there, I can't tell you how many kids I've dealt with who I started dealing with them at 15, and now they're 29 years old. They've been in and out of prison, and they're like going, I want to change my life. But for 15 years, they've committed tons of crime and cost us tons of money.
Representative Holvey poses an interesting question. How do you determine whether somebody's under the influence or not? I guess the next question, as this bill is written right now, you have to go further as to how do you determine what's on board. So maybe could you, I understand what the drug recognition expert's all about and what they're trained in for determining what may be on board for a person. Can you explain that a little bit to the committee?
You mean how we would determine that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, stimulants do certain things to bodies. You know, if you look at an addict who's on methamphetamine, I mean, we can sit back in about 30 seconds tell you because they're anxious, they're bouncing, they're sweating. Marijuana is the same thing. Their eyes will actually flutter when they've smoked it. They are very sleepy. Heroin's the same thing. You know, makes your pupils pinpoint and puts them almost in a dream state. So there's certain things that we're trained to identify. We can identify basically maybe the category of drug, maybe not the specific drug, but whether it's a stimulant, a depressant, or something along those lines. And then it goes back as through investigation techniques of how we investigate, how we do that. So there's all sorts of different steps. We could follow it up even through urine testing, through drug tests.
That would be a whole different ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
But
thank you, Mr. Chair. That leads me to another set of thoughts. This morning on the radio, I heard a discussion of the drinks that are being marketed now to young people involving lots of caffeine in some cases, other drugs that are not considered medications that are designed as relaxants kinds of things. I can't name them for you. I don't remember. But how would you go about differentiating that kind of effect on the body from these things that nobody thinks anything about? Mountain Dew has huge amounts of caffeine in it. I wouldn't let kids drink that stuff, but people do.
Mm-hmm.
How would you differentiate that kind of effect from the effect of a moderate amount of these drugs that are clearly illegal and clearly extremely dangerous?
With no disrespect, I can tell you a person who's on a stimulant drug over a Mountain Dew, there's a lot of differences in how they are. So it's not, I mean, caffeine's one thing, you can see that, and I mean, we deal with that all the time, but that doesn't stand out to you. People who are on drugs that would cause a stimulant effect, those stand out to you. I dealt with a 13-year-old girl here not too long ago at a middle school who was on definitely a stimulant, who we couldn't even hold her down. She was just bouncing around, and she actually was going to punch out the middle school principal. And the more we talked to her, and finally we figured out what it was, you know, by talking to her. But she was sweating and just anxious, and I mean, she was just not even all there. So I mean, those are the things that stand out to you. So then you know. There's always those borderline cases, but again, if it's me telling you that if it's a borderline case, I'm not going to deal with it. I'm not going to take that next step if I can't for sure say this is what. That's how I would deal with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, panel. Next panel I'm going to have come up is Stacy Neal, Dave Holmberg, and Robin Henderson. And then Gail and Andrea, I'll have you up next after. Pardon me? Okay. Proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Hunt and Chair Olson. I'm Stacy Neal, and I'm a former prosecutor with the District Attorney's Office in Bend, Oregon. I was a juvenile prosecutor for 7 years, and just recently changed jobs and now work at a child abuse assessment center. However, I felt very strongly about this particular bill and wanted to follow through on it. So specifically, I think I might be able to answer a few of the questions that came up about the process and how we would see logistics and how the cases would be handled. As Officer Maunder stated, you know, there's going to be those kinds of cases that could be close where we can't specifically identify what might be the particular drug that's on board. And in those cases, we're not going to pursue the case, obviously. We're looking at the more obvious situation we're talking about, and our intent was obviously a violation. It's much different than I think the bill is drafted currently and how you're talking about it. We're not looking at making it a crime to possess by consumption. So we're going to invest the kind of resources that would correlate with a violation. And I think it's important to understand there's a distinction in how we handle juvenile cases versus how we handle adult cases. And the juvenile code specifically has a purpose section that talks about the importance of providing a continuum of services that emphasizes prevention of future criminal activity. And we see this really as an avenue and opportunity to prevent further criminal activity. As we know, there's a high correlation between the number of crimes or percentage of crimes and substance abuse. So just to give you an idea, in Deschutes County, the way we would handle it, we have a continuum of intervention. So you'd start off at the first level as a diversion through the juvenile department, and that gives the youth an opportunity to participate in a program where they would do drug and alcohol assessment, follow through with classes or treatment, whatever the recommendations might be. And the second level being, it's called a formal accountability agreement. These are all based on statute, and each county and state has the opportunity to provide those levels of intervention. Again, that's short of going to court. It's a little bit more involved in that they go to the juvenile department, enter into a contract, and agree to do certain terms and conditions, and that would typically include a drug and alcohol assessment and follow through with the recommendations for treatment. And then the third level would be going to court. And in Deschutes County, we basically give kids two opportunities at those lower levels. Once they get their third referral for an MIP or a possession of less than an ounce, and we treat this one by consumption the same way, then they would go to court. And the consequence at the court level is having a license suspension. A lot of times kids, that's a deterrent for them to avoid those license suspensions. So at the diversion and FAA level, they have an opportunity to have it expunged, just seen as an opportunity to try to get in and have some teeth to making sure that these kids are getting some kind of services. But we have statistics pulled from the juvenile department, and of those kids who did MIP and possession of less than an ounce formal accountability agreements in 2010, they were 74% successful in successfully completing the treatment or those requirements. And that's, I think, a really high statistic, and I think a good opportunity for us to capture some more kids who are not, you know, showing up high to school, or you see them high down at the park and they don't have the drugs on them, but we know there's an issue. This will give us an opportunity to capture those kids that we're missing. I really don't see, when we look at a kind of a fiscal impact, I don't see it being an issue in the court system, because we have a system already in place for equivalent violations. The juvenile system is set up to address exactly these kinds of cases. We have, it rises to the court level. We have mass arraignments already for these violations. We have probation officer assigned, kind of does in mass supervision of these violation cases, and I don't have to create any new systems or programs. It's already in place. So I think that's a positive, and I really think it's worth the effort to try to capture some more kids and make more of an impact early on.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt, my name is Dave Holmberg, and I'm an administrator with the Van Lapine School District and have been for about 20 years. And in that time, I have worked primarily in student discipline, so I've worked with these cases for a long period of time. And one of the questions that I've heard a couple of times so far is, how do you know, or how can you tell if a person, if a youth is under the influence? And what I can tell you from my experience after 20 years is they tell you. They just admit it. That's what school administrators do when they have these kind of questions come up in the school. They talk to the youth, and typically the youth will, after a conversation, they'll say, yeah, you know, we did, we smoked, we were behind the school, or we were just off campus, or whatever. One of the questions was, how do teachers know, and how are teachers trained, or are they trained, to recognize the signs of substance abuse or being under the influence? And what our teachers typically are trained to do is not to be able to identify or spot students who are under the influence in any specific or detailed way, but what we ask them to do, since they work with the students on a day-to-day basis in the classroom and see them typically when they're not under the influence, is to let us know, get the word to the office or to an administrator in the school if the student is not right. And so they would typically contact the office if they have any concern, either whether they could be under the influence or if they're not well or if they're sick or if something about the student is such that there's a concern over their health and safety. And sometimes that would be in the area of substance abuse, and sometimes it just could be a student who's really ill. So then the administration's role would be to talk to the student, find out what's going on with them, and you know, examine the information that's available to us. And as I said before, typically in cases where substance use has been an issue, the student will just tell you, yeah, here's what happened. We went at lunch, or before school we met in a certain place. One of the things that we've been able to do, I've been able to track some data over 5 years of time, and it just be real quick with it. And in the issue of drug instances or drug referrals in the school, at my particular high school, Mountain View, we have data going back to, glasses on, data back to the 06-07 school year, and then each successive school year along. And in that category, in those years, by the way, the drug and alcohol were combined, and then in the most recent number this year, this school district has separated them out. So the last number you hear is going to be marijuana only. But for those years, starting in 06-07, for drug and alcohol violations, the number was 22. Then it went to 29 and 48 and 30. And currently, in this school year, with marijuana only, the number is 71. So it's a significant increase in the school year. And one of the things that I'm, having done this for a long, long time, one of the things that I am seeing more often than not when I do these investigations is that I'm finding an increase in the situations where the students who are using are not bringing it with them on campus. They're aware now that they will get a citation if they're caught with a bag or a pipe in their pocket at school. So, and they know that, and they want to avoid those citations if they can. And so what they do is they hide their stuff off campus. It's, you know, in a bush or in Central Oregon under a piece of lava rock. but they're keeping it somewhere off campus, nearby, close enough to get to during the lunch period or before or after school, so that they can get it and use it but not take the risk of having it in their possession, because they know if they are caught and they are under the influence, and even if they admit that they're under the influence, that there's typically no citation for that. So while they take the same school penalty as a student who has it in their possession, they get to go home without a ticket in their pocket.
Okay.
Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt, my name is Dr. Robin Henderson, and I'm representing the Oregon Psychological Association today. I've been working in mental health and addictions for more than 25 years, don't exactly want to admit how long. But I spent the first 15 years of my career working in addiction, specifically with adolescents. And I'm going to let my more learned colleague, Heather Crow-Martinez from Best Care, talk to you a little bit more about brain development. But in the time when I was working in addictions with these kids, we knew that the earlier we could intervene and have some teeth, the more successful we could be to stop the progression of what would inevitably happen. When the kids got to me, they were adolescent felony offenders who'd all done a few weeks at McLaren and had been fairly significant histories of alcohol and other drug use. Having a tool that allows you to have some teeth to help these kids move
a little bit closer and get the help they need before they end up at McLaren and end up in the system is what the Oregon Psychological Association is really interested in. So we wanted to express our support for that today. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, members. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm very, very impressed with that 74% number. That's a tremendous outcome, and I'm assuming Dr. Anderson's just recent comment that catching people early makes a big difference. Can you give us a quick hint of how you measure that success in order to get to that figure?
Sure, and actually I have to give the credit to the juvenile department, a separate kind of attorney's office, and they provided me with that statistic.
Microphone.
And I know that they do...
You want to move the microphone over in front of you? Thank you.
I know what they take into account is when they lay out the requirements of the contract, it will include getting a drug and alcohol assessment and successfully completing the recommendations of that treatment. It could include doing community work service hours. It could include any other number of things that kid is presenting with. They have to successfully complete everything, meaning do the assessment, complete treatment successfully, graduate, end with a clean UA, complete all the requirements in order to be successful. If they were kicked out of treatment or if they picked up a new charge, that would be an unsuccessful completion.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. I'm assuming that, for the most part, these are people who you catch early before they had the kind of brain neurological CNS changes that Dr. Henderson refers to.
Correct. That's the hope.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, Gail Meyer, Andrea Meyer, and Mara Roach. Gail, if you're ready, just point out to the ladies, this is not judiciary.
And how is it different? Thank you, co-chairs.
There's still a no on all the bills, though, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We learned a lot listening to the testimony in finding out now that the bill is not trying to create criminal penalties in the range of B and C felonies and whatnot, but just a violation. And it does change some of my comments, but not all of them. Firstly, I want to let the committee know that I don't think there are that many other states that have done this or do this. The vast majority of states do make it, do penalize possession of alcohol by consumption by minors. But I did, I made a concerted effort to find other states that do possession by consumption of controlled substances, and the best my information could get me was that South Dakota did make some amended language changes in 2001 that would pick up this concept, but I don't know of any other state that has. So I only comment that to the committee to say, in a way, we're kind of out there on uncharted territory by doing this. Secondly, I'd like to point out that while the bill apparently is not attempting to create a crime, and I will ignore that for now, it is limited to folks who are 21 years and younger. And I don't know if that was an attempt to mirror the minor in possession laws for alcohol, which says that anyone in possession by consumption of alcohol younger than 21, you know, commits a violation. But it's unlawful for anyone of any age to have unlawful possession of controlled substances, over 21, under 21. So I'm really not sure why the 21-year mark there is in there. This bill is not limited to students. It's not limited to people who are of student age, and you don't even have to be in school to have run afoul of this bill. I've appreciated listening to the conversations about how does the rubber really hit the road here. And there are pronounced differences between our MIP laws that exist now as it relates to alcohol and this bill. Alcohol smells. It just smells. I mean, there's an objective external indicator that person has alcohol in their body. What's interesting about this whole concept of possession by consumption, the real evidence that convicts is inside the person's body. And so there's a lot of search and seizure issues here that can skew the whole analysis but make it problematic. In order to be found guilty of a violation of unlawful possession of a controlled substance, they would have to identify the particular controlled substance. It couldn't just simply be a Schedule II drug. They would have to specifically say Ritalin. They couldn't simply say some kind of a barbiturate. They would have to identify it with specificity in order for it to be prosecuted as a violation. So the question becomes, how do you know exactly what specific controlled substance is in this kid's body? And the testimony is pretty much the kids, they're talking about, again, high school age kids, are pretty forthcoming, and I would agree that they probably are. But what would you do if they're not? Then how would you prove this? There was one reference in prior testimony that they basically wouldn't prosecute. But if there were an attempt to prosecute, they would have to go get a urine sample or a blood sample. But you can't get a warrant on a violation. So I don't really know how the dominoes would line up. If, in fact, the idea here is to simply get kids to admit, and those are the only ones that they would refer, because if they didn't admit, they wouldn't be able to prove it, and so let's just let it go, then you're passing a bill that would penalize something, create a violation on something, where you're dependent on the person confessing to the crime in order to prosecute, because you couldn't get the evidence any other way. If anybody follows what I'm saying, I hope you do. If you're to extrapolate from the training of officers, just about all officers through their DPSST training are certified to arrest someone for drunk driving for alcohol. They can put them through the field sobrieties, they can take them back to the station, they can do the breathalyzer exam, they can determine whether or not someone is impaired by driving because they've consumed alcohol. But to determine if a driver is impaired because they've consumed a controlled substance is a very specialized, particularized form of training and field. Those are called drug recognition experts, DREs. And there's very few of them. But they have to go through very rigorous training, and they have to go through a 12-point protocol in order to make that determination and conclusion. And the last determination is a urine analysis, which has to be forensically examined. So it's not the same as saying that you can determine whether someone's drunk by alcohol as to say that you know exactly what drug is in their system for the purpose of a referral to a juvenile court. I was going to list a litany of costs that were present in the bill, but that was predicated on the notion that these were crimes. There are costs in this bill, but I will defer those if anyone has any questions. Thank you.
Laura?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Maura Roach, and I'm testifying on behalf of Planned Parenthood. I think, you know, I too learned a lot more about the intention of this bill through hearing the testimony of the proponents. I think what I would like to do is just flag for the committee concerns that have been, Planned Parenthood has testified on bills sort of related to this over the years, which is just being very concerned about creating any sort of chilling effect on women seeking prenatal care, seeking hospital-based delivery, any sort of notion that, you know, in a medical setting, you know, this blood or other kinds of testing may be done, and being able to tell that someone's consumed a controlled substance, any sort of chilling effect or fear that a youngster might have, a pregnant teen might have, or in this case actually until 21, that might have a chilling effect or make them back away from being involved with, again, prenatal
care, testing, visits, or hospital-based delivery or postpartum care has always been a concern for this organization. I think this is not structured exactly as some of the more overt bills addressing these issues in the past, but it is a concern that we continue to have whenever we see something like this, because we want to make sure that young women, especially young women who may be somewhat in denial about the fact that they are pregnant and already reluctant or hesitant to be involved with the medical system, we don't want to fracture that very tenuous relationship that might be there. So it's something I would like you to keep in mind as you decide to proceed or not proceed with amendments around this so that there's not an unintended consequence. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrea.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We, too, appear here in opposition to House Bill 3673 and appreciate, as the others have, the clarification. However, I think, as Gail mentioned, even moving this to a structure of a violation is extremely problematic for the reasons she discussed. And I would just note a few quick things. One, when we are talking about violations, I just want to remind folks, especially as non-judiciary members, that there is no right to an attorney when you are facing a violation. And while the minor in possession structure has issues around court process and treatment and contracts and threat of removal of a driver's license, we are expanding that greatly in terms of putting someone into the justice system without the right to counsel. I would also note, because this does include controlled schedules that are lawfully prescribed, you know, just as an example, Ritalin, as Gail mentioned, is actually a Schedule II, which actual possession of it is a C felony already. So I think once you get into the possession of some of these that are, when they're not, they don't have the prescription for it, you're already into serious criminal issues. But glad to know it won't be two C felonies in both possession and consumption. But ACLU just feels that, in general, this is not the right approach. I think what we all can agree on is treatment opportunities and the ability to access those by the family and the schools and others, I think, is a larger problem. And I think that, unfortunately, comes down to the big words of funding. I suspect for, and I know little about this area, but I've heard, and I think someone mentioned, you have to hit rock bottom. You have to be ready for treatment, unfortunately, to really be successful at it. So I'm not sure forcing folks into treatment in some of these things is really going to get us there, but certainly we need the money and the funds there to provide the kinds of treatment necessary for the health, which I think we all agree needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Well, any questions?
Make a question speechless.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, then I have next Heather Crow. She stepped out. Okay, Sandria Seafelt. And, or Sandra, excuse me. Yeah, come on up, Sandra. And then we have Archie Hamilton, and I think that's it.
Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt and the rest of the committee, my name is Archie Hamilton. I'm a drug and alcohol counselor at an adolescent facility in Sisters, Oregon called Bridges Academy. My testimony today, though, is going to come from the perspective of an addict. I'm a recovering methamphetamine addict. I have 6.5 years clean. My addiction took me on a lot of tours. I toured a lot of probation offices, jail cells, treatment centers, and I got a chance to tour the Oregon prison system due to my addiction. My problems started in the eighth grade. My first drug of choice was alcohol, and I learned, as an addict, I was really good at manipulating systems. And I learned early on, after the first couple of tickets that I got for minor in possession by consumption of alcohol, it was at about that point where my drug of choice became marijuana, and alcohol kind of faded away. I would continue to go to school high on marijuana from the 8th grade on until I failed out of the 12th grade and experienced a lot of family problems, academic failure, and I got caught up in the system. I truly believe with all my heart that if I would have had some intervention early on, that there's a chance that maybe I could have got myself turned around with some legal consequences to where I could have made some better choices before I crossed that line from abuse to addiction. Because once I crossed that line and became an addict and became chemically dependent, the choice was gone for me. And addiction led me through a life of crime. I hurt everybody that I loved the most. I used against my will, and it took me a long time to get out of it. And I've heard some testimony today. The earlier we catch this thing, the easier it is for us to get out. And I truly believe in that. I also do a lot of intervention work with the high schools, with Mr. Monder, with parents of addicts and adolescents. And I do know that the adolescents that I work with that have legal consequences over their head do a lot better in the intervention work that we do. So I'm here to support this bill. I truly believe the earlier we can catch this thing, the better chances that we have of getting things turned around. Thank you.
Sandra?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, and members of the committee. I'm Sandra Seifelt, and I'm here representing House Bill 3673 as a parent of a student at Summit High School in Deschutes County. I have three boys, ages 12 to 17. My husband and I have family history of alcohol addiction and nicotine. My oldest son started experimenting with drugs and alcohol in around the 7th and 8th grade. And it escalated and increased a little more as he got into high school. And that's how I got to know Officer Monder. And, you know, the counselors, the teachers, the coaches, the administrators, they all know those kids, and they all know when they're right and when they're not right in their mind and their parents and their behavior. And I think there are less kids today going to school under the influence of alcohol than under the influence of these other controlled substances. And I'm sad to say that I know that because I've talked to my son and his friends. And, you know, they tell me things. And they also know, kids know, they're smart, they know what they can get away with and what they can't get away with. And so they, you know, like you said, you know, if you're going to get caught because you have alcohol in your breath and you're going to, you know, do something else, these kids just do what they can. And I got called in by Officer Monder for something unrelated. Well, it's not even unrelated, but it wasn't an alcohol or drug issue. But, of course, those poor choices and bad behavior are escalated when they're under the influence of these other substances. And, you know, I would prefer that we would have stopped the behavior before it becomes criminal. And in this case, you know, I asked Officer Monder, well, what can the school do when you see these kids, you know, under the influence? And, you know, how can you help me? Because as a parent, I only have so much influence. My husband with me, we only have so much influence. They're only at our home so many hours a day. They're at school a great amount of their day. And I was told, well, you know, there's really nothing that I can do to help you. If they're under the influence, they can get sent home, be suspended. And I said, well, that's great. That's just a free day home from school to, you know, get into more trouble. So I just find that we do need something else that deters these kids from making these poor choices. We don't want them to go from experimenting and casual use to abuse and addiction. And in our case, we did have to go to the route of a formal accountability agreement. Again, not specifically related to drugs and alcohol. And that agreement, of course, when you have no further problems, you get your record expunged when you're 18, and that's a great deterrent. I mean, my son does not want to have a record when he's 18, and I think this kind of bill would help kids like my son, who's not yet, you know, a big troublemaker. We'd like to prevent that. Thank you.
Questions? Archie, you said that it was marijuana that you started using in the eighth grade. That's about the age that you started?
Yes, sir.
And Sandra, that was about the same time that your oldest son was doing that?
Yes.
It's interesting, members, that Oregon leads the nation right now in the eighth graders reporting the use of marijuana nationally. Just thought you'd find that interesting. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Anybody else like to speak on this bill? Okay. Seeing that,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would simply note, as we talk about addictive substances, that the brain chemistry studies that I'm aware of make it pretty clear that adolescents are extremely vulnerable to becoming addicted as a result of brain chemistry changes that occur with drug use. And of course, that includes all addictive substances, tobacco, as well as all the drugs we're talking about here, and probably some of the other drugs that are not legally classified as drugs that I was mentioning when we talked about some of the soft drinks that are currently being developed and are on the market. I'm afraid this is an area that we and others will probably have to start paying attention to more than we have. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Bill of 2011.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming and testifying on this. We're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3673, and we are adjourned.